Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 73. I didn't happen to have my podcast equipment with me right now, so if you're wondering why this sounds a little different, it's because I am literally recording the podcast intro just directly on my phone. A little bit silly, but might as well try new things, right? So anyway, this is a really awesome podcast. This is one of the several that I recorded at FMX, and it's a really cool one. And it's featuring two great guys, Andreas Fiechs and Francisco Ferrana. They are Film Academy graduates. Film Academy is in Stuttgart, or near Stuttgart, right around, which is kind of coincidence with FMX. Really, really cool school. And we talk about the amazing school it is and what it was like to get an education there and why is it very, very different from other schools. What's also cool about these two guys is they made a short called City Party, which won the VES Awards Best Student Film at the VES number 14. So very, very exciting for those guys. And we got to talk about what that was all about as well. So hopefully you enjoy it. Before we conclude this podcast, we've got a couple of Ask Vlados out there, and I wanted to go over those with you. As you know, if you want to go and ask a question to Ask Vlado, by the way, you just go onto Twitter, Facebook, or whatever, connect with us on social media, either at CG underscore labs for Chaos Group Labs, or at Chaos Group, or go on Facebook, whatever. Just let us know what you're interested in finding out. Ask Vlado, hashtag it with Ask Vlado, and then we will ask him, and he will read them back, just like we're doing now. Okay, this one's from Twitter. It's from at Moodstrike, and it says, ask Vlado if he had one job to create some stills to Xeon chips or for Titan GPUs. I know it's not simple as that. Plus, both would be nice. Hashtag 3D. All right, Vlado's response was very simple. For Titans, definitely, if you want the fastest results. And then the next question is from at Garage Farm. And the question is, ask Vlado, what is the biggest constraint at the moment for GPUs to go mainstream and be on par with CPU rendering? Vlado's response is, I think there is not really that many major constraints. One needs to think differently about the code flow and how a program is executed on the GPU. But by now, we are mostly aware of which approaches work on the GPU and which ones don't, and it's just a matter of coding. It's a bit more difficult to arrange that things happen in the correct order and get the most speed out of the GPU. So that's why programming them is a bit more difficult, but it's moving along a bit slower than I would have liked, but it's partly because there's a lot of experimenting going on. Just a reminder, obviously, there's a lot of interest in GPU stuff, which is great. And so in not long from now, we will be releasing the guide to GPU. We did the guide to VR, and we'll be doing the guide to GPU. I've been working hard with that with Blago. It is a very long document, and hopefully you guys will have all of your questions asked and find out more about why GPU is important and how it's going to affect the future of rendering. All right, guys, appreciate it. Hopefully you guys enjoy the podcast intro. Sorry I wasn't able to record them on my microphones, but this will be fine, right? All right, guys, thanks.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Thanks so much for being here. I've been wanting to talk to some people. You both came from the Film Academy, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So I've been wanting to talk to students who are, or people who have been going through there for a while and sort of understand a little bit more about it, because that school is kind of incredible, and I like the way that it's run. And I want to sort of give people an idea about what the Film Academy is and how you're able to do things like that City Buddy project, right?
Okay. I think one of the sort of the main differences compared to like other film schools is mainly that whereas in other courses, schools, they have more the sort of the basic courses where if they teach you something about film, about media and television or visual effects, post-production, animation, it's right. All very standard, sort of like by the book, and you get an insight into how it's done, but it's not in the way that you really get some practical experience, how it sounds. So you only learn sort of the theoretical parts. And if you learn about 3D software, it's also like just a very basic understanding, but you never like really
get to use it
in any way. And in our case, it's pretty much from the first year, even though we don't do animation, we learn how to actually make our own movies.
Right.
And what's the process behind it, what it means to be to be a director on set and to direct actors, to edit your film.
Right.
So even though you would never use it anymore, you still have like the basic understanding, even if it's just animation that you do.
Okay.
And even when it comes to animation, you also just learn the methods on how to implement animation or how to approach it.
Okay.
But you don't learn how to use the software, so that's something that you do on your own.
So literally learning the software is like your responsibility. There's no formal education for that, right?
No. If we got problems with something or want to be to learn something more in depth, we can tell them, and they then get us people from the industry who will come there and give special courses. I don't know, for example, a special expert course for Nuke or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, but usually but most of the time it's not focused on Nuke, for example, but it's more like just to how to, for example, understand the basics of compositing, which probably is going to be done in either Nuke or After Effects, because that's what most of the people use.
Uh-huh.
But if you actually want to use Nuke, then it's sort of a little bit more your responsibility to open it or see if the other students who might have a little bit more experience can help you. But the fact that you learn it for yourself also makes it a lot more rewarding, because it's not mandated that you have to do it. But if you learn it on your own, then of course it's just a lot more encouraging just to learn the software and then actually use it on your project, which has a higher benefit for yourself as well.
Yeah.
So they have the basic course that's going about 2.5 years, where you learn everything, as Andres told, and then you're entering like a project phase where you work directly on projects, and from the fourth year on you have to choose to think about new ideas for your diploma project. And then they give you practically an infrastructure with the computers and the software you need and everything. And they
a studio.
Yes, and they let you decide and build up a pipeline from the beginning of. They have no mandatory pipeline. The students can or should build that up for themselves to learn how the process works.
I mean, it's like you're making your own studio. Right?
Yes, it's
in sort of way.
It's
so it's like just
so you've got the trainings of making your own company already, right as you graduate.
Yes, in every aspect. Yeah. So
you group together with other students. You say, okay, you're
yes,
and, okay.
Yes, that's also mandatory. We have like, they call it project heads. So we have one responsible. We need four people minimum responsible for our projects. Mm-hmm. One is for the content. One is for the visuals. One is for the technical part, and one is a producer. And
that, okay.
Yeah, so in our in our case, Andreas was content, visual, and technical responsible for everything. That's not usual, but
they still allow it, because it gets a lot more difficult just to get a project off the ground, because the less people have, the more responsibility they have to share. And then, of course, if something happens to the project, nobody can take it over. So,
but we have to prove that we can do that. So showed at our talk yesterday, we need to do a proof of concept, like a test shot.
And, exactly.
And if they then see that it is doable with that constellation, we get...
They need reassurance that you're not going to do something that's inachievable, right?
Yeah.
And waste money on stuff that's not going
to happen. But still, of course, they have to keep the flexibility, because if someone doesn't want to make like this really complicated project, it's just like a 2D animator doing something really quiet, then you don't need like four people just to make the small movie.
Sure.
And they still have to keep it like, okay, still someone even some one person can just take all four responsibilities.
How do you guys get a budget?
Well, in that case, sort of, because it's more like a more theoretical budget.
Mm-hmm. But you have resources at the school that you use, right?
We have resources. I mean, we're not, we can use them, but of course we also shouldn't be like completely spoiling them because we have to work with other projects.
Right.
So, yeah, I think I can give a good answer at that because that's my responsibility as a as a producer, and we have on every part of the project, for example, a workstation, we have like an like a budget for that, you know, so a workstation costs so and so much.
Oh, so you have like a, like you said, a theoretical budget.
It's a theoretical budget we have to work with, and we have to calculate it and at the beginning and do like a bidding how much it would cost, and so we can also see if the resources are available in this way. Yes. That's
actually pretty good. Yeah. So I mean, that also forces you not to like you say, abuse the system. You can't just get all the computers in the school because you have that has to come out of your budget, you know, like quote unquote budget.
We have also to do like a forecast of our render times because when our projects are in the final phase. It's like we have the trailers for the International Trickfilm Festival, and we have our diploma project, and they collide always.
Right.
It's always at the same time because the deadlines are the same.
Right.
And then we have we have regular meetings where we show our calculations and render times, what we think we will need, and then we talk about how to share it and who has render priority and on which part of the week and everything.
Well, that's actually really, I mean, it makes sense to do something like that, but I've never, like you said, it's different from other schools I've ever seen and what they do. And how long is the whole program? Like, so you said first 2 years, you're doing a little bit of basic, like just catching up, I guess, learning stuff. Do people go into the school, do they already know a lot of stuff before they go there?
It depends. I mean, they have a requirement that you have like at least 12 months of practical experience, so pretty much a year. But it's not like you have to have already worked like exactly for those 12 months.
So okay.
It's more like you have worked in the industry in some capacity for 12 months, but it's not like, for example, somebody who has to do animation has already been to like the best visual effects company as an intern and that's his practical experience.
Right.
But sort of, it's more like a firewall to see that if someone actually wants to study film, that they have some form of dedication. And, but depending on your background, you already sort of bring some experience with you.
Yeah.
And of course, then it's also part of the studies that you actually share the experience with other people who might have a different background than you.
And how competitive is this school?
I think it depends a little bit on the subject.
I mean, competitive meaning how hard is it to get in to school?
Well, they have some procedure. When you apply, you have to do a test. So you have to apply with your work first, and if you are selected for the next round, you have an interview, and then you have to you get a task for the weekend, and you have to solve it for yourself without
any help
of the school. And when you're done on next Monday, you have to present it, and they ask you questions about that, and then you have to wait and hope that you get accepted.
Well, how many people get in every year, approximately?
I mean, usually it's on the average of 15 people who then actually get accepted.
15.
Yeah, yes. But just at the Institute of Animation.
Yeah, that's for the animation branch. So
okay,
each and every course, sort of the main courses, they always have like between 14 and 16 people, I'd say, unless that has changed in recent years. But and then I also like for example, smaller courses where there's like the teams and also the lectures are a lot more, a lot smaller. Then of course it's probably like just 3 or 5 people especially if it's, for example, a new course, which they just added like in recent years, which isn't that prominent yet.
That's okay. So that's very selective.
But yeah,
so that's very, very selective, which is, I mean, it's good. There's a good reason why Film Academy is considered such a strong and powerful school, which is good. And you were joking when I was saying how competitive. You assumed that I said how competitive are you amongst each other?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like obviously since it's so small, you either are very competitive or you have no choice but to bond with anyone.
I mean, sometimes it's more like we're rather competitive over resources, but usually given that everybody sort of has their own specialty,
right?
And you're not big, and especially their own style. So there's not really. There's not really much room to actually clash in some way because the outcome is different, whatever, whoever, in which way each and every person makes his movie.
Right.
I mean, it can happen from time to time if you have like technical guys who want to butt heads. Or so, but it's never like in a regular school system where everybody tries to get the best grades, because it's more like everybody finds a different art style and.
It's more a matter of time and resources. Mm-hmm. I thought the most time we had discussions were about time and resources, because you can do your own film in that last phase at your diploma phase, and there are some people who really want to do their own film, and if too many people are want to do their own film, there is nobody left who can help making the film. That's sort of the only problem that could interfere.
But even then, it's sort of like a little bit of a tug of war, because if, for example, then people all want to join in one project, then of course that's also like taking away people from other projects. So it's always like also push and pull all the time, depending on what a certain project needs, or how many students are actually available, or what they actually do. So it's actually pretty sort of, but it also changes like from year to year, just depending on how the students are.
But in the end, that's also a part of the learning process, how to solve this one.
I think. And so you have to work with. I mean, you're pretty much put into a functional work environment, and you're going to deal with these problems. Everywhere,
yes.
So you have to, in order for you to be able to be good at it. I mean, basically, when people come out of film academy, it's very clear that they come in complete. Like, how long does it take? Four years, and then you do your final project after the fourth year, right?
After the fourth year, you will start with your final project,
which is about a year, one and a half.
So
5.5 years, and it looks like pretty much when you come out of there, you have at least 5 years experience. It sounds like that to me, which is true, because I don't think you're. I mean, you've got a new job, right?
Yeah.
where are you going to go? Can you tell me?
Yeah, I will go to MPC London, MPC Commercials.
Great.
As a producer. Yeah.
As a producer.
Yes.
Wow. Fantastic. What about you? Did you both graduate this year, right?
No, Andreas graduated last year.
Oh yeah.
I had a little bit of a head start, but okay.
Where are you working now?
I'm actually also at MPC Advertising in London.
Okay.
Currently as a 2D artist.
There you go. Okay. Well, that's great.
There's another aspect for the experience, because some of us can go to can take a year off after the basic course and go to work somewhere. And gain experience.
An internship?
And a lot of artists are doing that. So if they come out, they have 6.5 years or six years, and they also have another year experience in the industry directly. That's also helping.
That's very good. My architecture school at Rice, for their undergraduate program, in order to get your bachelor's of architecture, you did 4 years, and then they sent you off to work at a high-end architecture firm for 1 year, and then you'd come back, and then you'd finish one more year, and then you'd get your bachelor of architecture. And it was pretty good. People do get a lot of experience from doing that, and I think they're much more ready to go into the workforce.
And of course, the benefit of just spending a year out in the field and working with professionals, then of course you can also build up a few more connections.
Absolutely.
So you don't just leave the film academy and have to start anew.
Do you have a lot of relationships with other people who graduated from film academy and say, obviously, right? So you connected back with him, and that's how you probably got the job, right?
No, actually, I met those guys 2 years ago at FMX, and I kept contact. So, Yeah, but it's it's pretty much the same for Andreas, I think. So we keep a close contact to the industry, and that's cool, you know, because they are also organizing the FMX and have a lot of contacts to the industry, and that's how it works. But the other thing is that a lot of our graduates are working also at those companies, and we know a lot of them who graduated 2 years ago, and we keep contact with them and we visit them.
Right.
This year we went to Los Angeles for the VS Award, and we visited also some of our friends who are working at Disney. So we went there and
it was pretty much as we had never left.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So this brings up a good point. You brought up the VES Award. So let's talk a little bit about your project and how that came about. Now we know you did it after you started after your fourth year, and you know the roles you played in it. Mm-hmm. But tell us about the project and how that was. And obviously it led to a nomination and a win of the VES Awards, right?
Yeah, it was a win as well.
Yeah, and it was for Best Student Film, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us a little bit about the project, what inspired it.
Well, first of all, sort of the first idea I had was like I wanted just to make something with dinosaurs as my graduation project. Because
why dinosaurs?
It's sort of like a lifelong fascination. It was something that sort of... sort of came in, went, and then came back again. It's sort of like almost like a bit of a relationship with different interests, but it's sort of like one that stuck with me the most.
Okay.
Because it sort of grew on me with like the first children's books I had, and then watching Jurassic Park when I was 6 years old, and was totally terrified by what I saw.
Right.
And I think it came back sort of during my time at Film Academy, when I sort of also collected a bit more experience, and then I was actually sort of like the stuff that I saw at Jurassic Park, now I'm actually a little bit able to do that as well.
Okay.
And sort of my project in my third year, which was also for the Animated Film Festival, was just a 1 minute trailer of a small dragon running through a museum.
Uh-huh.
And that was sort of like my first test, just to try and do a CG character and integrate it into live action, sort of pretty much the same thing that they did on Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be pretty successful, and that sort of...
Wait, how old are you?
I'm 27.
27, okay. So Jurassic Park was already done, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was...
yeah.
No, you must have been like a few years old when Jurassic Park came out.
I mean, right? It was released when I was five, but...
Five.
I saw it on a VHS copy, right, when moved back to Germany, so...
Yeah.
But then it was still, I was like cowering behind the bookshelf when I was sort of close to the final scenes.
Yeah, I know. My son is actually, he's six, and he's been wanting to see Jurassic Park. So,
I had the luck to watch it in cinema there. I was old enough.
Yeah.
But I felt pretty much the same. So.
Yeah. No, I think it was really cool. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that obviously Jurassic Park was one of the most influential things that got them into what they're doing. And I think you're right. It's an important thing, and making an homage to it is great.
And sort of in some way, it also, like with every Jurassic Park movie that was released, regardless of the quality, sort of each and every sort of, also sort of brought me a little bit more into the world of film and also visual effects. Because for the first one, of course, with 6 years, you don't understand at all how it's done.
No.
I mean, I saw an image where they put the CG dinosaur in, and I didn't understand what they were actually trying to tell me.
Right.
And then with the second one, I understood sort of a little bit more. Oh, yeah, they had puppets and animatronics and everything. And sort of with the third film, and also that was sort of the time when they had the Disney movie and the BBC series with dinosaurs, with one of those.
Oh, right.
Sort of these, when they had like a little dinosaur.
Walking with Dinosaurs.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a great series.
And when they released all this behind the scenes material, then I was, now it all makes sense to me.
Right.
And that also sort of like kickstarted also sort of my own interest in actually doing my own animation or short films, which was sort of like, even though it was back then, it was just, you just work with what you have.
So it sounds like it was the most natural thing for you to do, is to do something with dinosaurs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, I could just only work with Legos and start animating them. But then when I noticed, okay, now I can actually do the same things that they did back then when they released the movies, then it came back in full swing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really cool. Do you have an interest in dinosaurs?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's as I told, it's pretty much the same with Jurassic Park. Yeah. And and at that time I also bought magazines and tried to learn everything. Mm-hmm. And I know some types till today, but I'm not daring to I do not dare to compare my knowledge with the one of Andreas.
Right. I mean, so they're probably more dinosaur geeks out there who are vastly superior to me.
No,
Forgot a lot of names that I could spell out as a child, but yeah. I still follow the news, and whenever they have new discoveries, and of course I'm the first one who reads it.
Okay. Well, why don't you describe for people what happens in your short bit?
So it pretty much starts off with a small dinosaur, which is an oviraptor type species, mm-hmm. like one of those that are commonly known as the egg thieves. At least they were known until recent years. It pretty much just shows him in his environment, like how it behaves. It drinks from a pond, catches a lizard to eat it, but then suddenly looks up and you see in his eye that he's looking at the meteorite that's heading forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then we jump to an undefined period later, where the dinosaur is still alive, but he has to try to walk through this apocalyptic wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he's struggling very hard, he succumbs to his injuries, which he, of course, sustained from the impact,
mm-hmm.
and then tumbles and dies.
Oh, okay.
So he tries to get up, but he doesn't have the strength to stand up again.
Yeah.
And that's when pretty much he draws his last breath. But all of a sudden, he starts getting attacked by all the embers in his environment, and he stands up unexpectedly. Tries to flee and sort of stumbles back more and more into a weird nighttime version,
mm-hmm.
of the world he just lived in,
mm-hmm.
and slowly but surely it creeps into him that this is actually not his not the real world, but in his own mind, and he's being chased by the fear that he had when he had to witness that impact. But then the once he realizes that it's actually not that it's not real, that it's his own imagination or his own memory sort of coming back to him,
mm-hmm.
he makes a decision that he faces this his trauma, his fear, and it sort of comes a deus ex machina with the meteorite impact in his own mind.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And the last image is pretty much he jumps into the fire. The image becomes he becomes a phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also like the moment where dinosaur, both his body and mind, are completely dead at this point.
Right.
So in a metaphorical sense, he has probably gone to another plane, but in the real life, that's pretty much, that was his last moment that he experienced.
Okay. Well, how long is it?
It's about 6.5 minutes. Okay. Full CG animation was done in stereo.
I didn't know it was done in stereo.
The thing was that I was working on a few other projects at Film Academy. Sort of one of the first larger projects I worked on, like another graduation project, was The Rise and Fall of Globosome.
Oh, right.
Which had a similar pipeline to what I was working up to that point. And he was very interested to do a stereo movie.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was a big advantage that I could just use the same tools straight ahead, and also just trying to do stereo in a CG movie, of course, makes it more interesting than compared, for example, live action, because it's a lot more about the creative side of doing stereo instead of trying to come up with all the technicalities, how to make the shots align and everything. So
yeah.
Whereas it's a nightmare. It's a lot more. It's a lot more fun process because you can just set up your cameras, see what it looks like in stereo, and then just marvel at it. How much more dimension this might add to a shot. And at that point, it just started out, okay, we just work together, use this, just work on shots back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, I became sort of the lead stereographer on that project. And then the second another project called if I could do also stereo on that one as well.
Yeah.
And for like a good chunk of projects that were done in stereo, sort of I had my hands in them, or at least at some point I could actually consult them how the shots might work.
Okay.
But then when I did my own, it was time to do my own movie, I was like, okay, now I've told other people how they could do stereo in the films that they direct.
Mm-hmm.
Now I actually want to make a movie which I both direct, and I can sort of also direct the stereo in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of working with a frame that already exists, I can sort of pick and choose how my cinematography might work actually with stereo in mind.
Right, okay.
And that sort of became an interesting thing, like how to design camera moves, how to design angles,
mm-hmm.
sort of how to frame certain areas. So it's not only just visually interesting, but also like but might be interesting sort of...
In depth.
Yes.
Did you find that... Did you do a lot of stuff to sort of change the... You changed, obviously, the intraocular, right?
Mm-hmm.
As you're going from
yeah.
shot to shot. But did you also change the depth as well, like where the focus point was? Or did you have a lot of things coming out towards the screen?
I sort of kept that to a minimum, sort of like because something that comes out of... it's like I think it's one of those typical gags. We have to throw something at the audience just
yeah.
to remind them that it's in stereo. I sort of kept that sort of to a minimum just because it feels... At this point, it almost feels like a cheap gimmick unless it's done right or at the right moments.
Right.
But what I like to use is more like if something comes out and it almost feels a little bit more natural. If something, for example, gets too close and then dips back
yeah,
into the
I'm
screen just
said,
because it has to.
Yeah, because I think I 100% agree with you. I think people just like throw mm-hmm. things at the screen mm-hmm. all the time, you know. And it's usually like the opening shot mm-hmm. or something.
And I think so, like, it's like a fun little tidbit. So even though, for example, the movies Michael Bay does, like Transformers movies, even though then... The quality is not that good.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had some of my best stereo moments in them, and it's because he didn't throw something at the camera, but he actually uses the depth of all the debris and
right.
the destruction.
So it's like looking through a window instead.
Yeah, for example, even if it was just like some piece of paper flying up to the screen and then falling back down just because it's not directing the attention to itself because it's not the most prominent thing in the shot.
Right.
But the fact that you notice it and that it actually provides more depth to the shot was something that I found interesting.
Yeah.
My best stereo moment was the full screen Star Destroyer and IMAX of Force Awakens.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, that was good as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to add that as well, but of course then the movie was already finished.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, to be honest, I saw Star Wars Force Awakens in stereo and in 2D, and I preferred it in 2D. And the reason I preferred it in 2D is some of the shots had too much depth and they increased the interocular too much. Mm-hmm. Or especially when at the beginning when she was on the planet and she was doing the scavenging stuff, right?
Yeah.
They put too much interocular in there and everything looked like a miniature. Mm-hmm. And I wish they had kept it small because it looked in 2D, I felt that it looked bigger than in 3D. So.
Yeah, I'd say personally, I like both versions.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw the 2D version first and then I think the second version I didn't catch most of it because it was pretty late the second time I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I was already a little bit tired. But what I found interesting is that it actually feels a little bit more like they also like design some of the shots in a way that they actually can, they might even get improved by stereo sort of in a similar way I was thinking. Because just if you can actually use your object and sort of have it traverse like a certain portion of depth,
mm-hmm.
something that you would actually notice in stereo. That's something that I found quite interesting.
Yeah.
So it's not like, for example, if you have a lightsaber that it has to be pointed into the audience like it was done on Tintin, which was like pretty annoying.
Yeah.
But it's just something that if you actually notice that it actually has, it's pointed towards the audience,
right.
not in an invasive manner, but you can still notice that it actually has dimension to it.
Yeah, but I think sometimes when things are too much out of the mm-hmm. screen, it's just hard to focus on, them,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, it's good to know the limits on that one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how did the stereo kind of affect the overall budget of it and those things were?
In my opinion, not so much because it was Andreas did a very clever job in that. We planned it from the beginning and he prepared everything right away in stereo. He had just to. Yeah, just to render out the other eye,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
and his script was prepared. But I think he can tell it to you how did it, he did it technically. But from production side, it was only to render one frame more per yeah.
yeah okay.
And was it only just the two of you who did that whole thing?
We had a bit help of Natalia, a colleague of us, who mm-hmm. Did an overhaul of the textures and a bit higher resolution and everything.
Okay.
And we had two other friends who helped at the beginning with some concept paintings. But the mm-hmm. rest was done by Andreas mainly, mm-hmm. and by me for the production side. Yeah, but almost all artistic work was done by Andreas.
That's pretty amazing. And how long was it total to do it?
Overall, I think it was almost a year, just sort of preparing the movie, just making the concepts, doing the storyboards, and then rewriting the stories a couple of times after like speaking to our lecturers and guest lecturers.
Mm-hmm.
It was a few months of preparing the assets, so like mainly the main character and some of the side characters that appear in the film, and sort of prepare a few assets for the environments.
Yep.
And then the shot production itself was all done within 12 months. So wow. 1 year.
Okay, that's really cool. Well, how did you, what was I going to ask you, Saul? What about your render farm? Like, how are you guys rendering this stuff? Do you have a render farm resources at the university?
Yes, we have a render farm. It's we have dedicated render machines in our server room,
mm-hmm.
that is managed by our fabulous IT crew. Mm-hmm. They're really cool guys there. And we have also attached every workstation onto the render farm. Mm-hmm. And when it's, for example, the machine is idle for an hour or so,
mm-hmm.
It connects with the render farm, right. and uses, we use a software developed by one of our ex-colleagues, Holger Schönberger. He does mm-hmm. Royal Render. I don't know if you know.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of Royal Render, yeah.
Yeah, and that's our management, mm-hmm. yes. And so we can put the things directly on the render farm.
But if you're saying, okay, we need to render a bunch of stuff tonight, so...
Yes.
Do you allocate that and use those virtual money to do that, and then you have to go to the IT guys and say, okay, this project needs this much resources tonight, or how do you plan for that?
We can only we do that only at the crunch time, and when we know that every project is rendering and the deadline is near for everything.
Right.
Through the year we can just put it on the render farm when there are some slots free. It renders.
Okay.
So you can do that over the lunch break. You can do that sure. over there.
But do you get you know, quote unquote billed, you know, for your render time use?
No, we see how much it would cost.
Right.
We see it in the render control, in the render control. It shows us how many power is used and how yeah. much this would cost.
Right.
But
that's really good knowledge. You know, knowing how much, like, oh yeah, something like this is an expensive shot. We yes. can't do that.
Yes. So, but we can test it there, and we also if we see that it's too long or something like that, we can cancel it and do some tweaks and everything. Right.
I think the only real problems we run into if somebody just put something on the farm that renders for 10 hours for nothing, and then of course they have to answer for every other project because they sort of block the entire farm. So
you know, the other student can see that we have all access to the control, mm-hmm. and we can see if a project is
so of course it's
long running times.
Yeah, it's less a problem that because the resources are available, and if they're not used, then of course it's rather just something that's not getting spent or it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But the main problem is that, or sort of the main struggle is then just to make sure that everything runs in a democratic fashion, that everybody sort of gets their render time due and gets it done in time.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember this is back at, I think I was at Method, but anyway, I wasn't on the project, but a friend of mine, he was sort of leading the project, and I guess he had hired some people that were just out of school, and they were doing a big... they're modeling a big part of the city. It's a commercial, right? So a big city, huge thing. And the commercial, if you add it up, is a 30-second commercial, and it's 24 frames a second, so it's 720 frames, right? That's pretty much the whole commercial. Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, they don't want to do a turntable of this city, and they decided to do a to show what they had built, and they decided to do a fly through that was 2,500 frames. And so they had a bunch of shots to try to get out of the stuff, and it's like, well, the farm was used on this massive fly through, and he didn't get to use it. And it said, "Don't do that again. Don't do that again." We lost a day of rendering because of this.
Yeah, we had a couple of emails where just people were writing, "Okay, we just saw something render for 5 hours for just a piece of hair." And then sort of everybody has a good
laugh. Yeah, you get shamed. Yeah,
it's sort of like, but yeah, but it's not like Game of Thrones type shame. It's more like, okay, yeah, you proved your point now, and just make sure that it renders a little bit faster next time.
Right.
And we had a couple of projects, sort of like even in our own year, that's like, okay, some of them are just taking a little bit too long, so maybe you just have to take a look at your settings.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. Overall, was the rendering pretty good on your side? I mean, you were pretty efficient.
One thing was that I tried to keep it as the additional processes like motion blur, depth of field, sort of whatever, just adds to the rendering power, mm-hmm. or needs more render power and time, that I can sort of do most of the things afterwards in the compositing, where I have more control over them, and sort of that scale down render times pretty well.
Right.
So that sort of got alleviated a little bit, also that the fact that I rendered elements separately in a fashion that I can also like have a little bit more control in stereo, mm-hmm. the depth, but also like individual elements, like for example the environment and the characters.
Right.
Of course, it takes a lot longer if I render the elements separately. Sort of, there's a certain, it just adds a small percentage,
right?
Of course, of extra render time. But of course, if just one element has a render problem, then I only have to re-render that part.
Mm-hmm.
And just preparing everything a little bit better, that meant that I could just do a lot more in the compositing process, and that could also mean, okay, I don't have to re-render the shot entirely, because I can already sort of, whatever errors I might encounter or whatever sort of built into all those render files, don't worry, I can also fix it in compositing, and then I can just focus on the next shot or do the stereo version.
So what's your bigger strength, or what, obviously you said you're going as a 2D artist, mm-hmm. over at MPC, so do you feel yourself to be more of a compositor or a 3D guy?
I'd say more in the realm of a compositor. It's more like when I do 3D stuff, it's, for example, rendering, it's more that I try to make it or prepare it in a way that sort of benefits the compositing the best. So sometimes I won't be like finishing the rendering in at a quality where I say, okay, that's the best lighting, that's the best shading or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as I know I got all those elements available, then I can sort of still tweak them in perfect, as like almost in real time, because everything's already done.
Right.
And you can generate your own footage if you decide to, that you need on that point.
There's definitely a correlation, obviously, between lighting and compositing. You know, that's very strong. And some companies don't even separate them. Some companies basically say that the compositor as the lighter is the same.
Mm-hmm.
That is not great, but you also animated, right?
You
did everything, so. That must have been that's pretty good. That's pretty amazing. This led to the VES Awards. So tell us a little bit about the VES Awards. How does that affect you guys?
Well,
you guys got to come out to Los Angeles.
Yeah. So we went there without knowing if we would win or not.
Right.
Well, it's more like.
But you submitted it, right? So what's the process of the VES Awards?
Yeah.
How to apply? Or
Usually it's either the school or the individuals who apply for or just enter, mm-hmm. make a submission for the VES Award. If you do it for yourself, then of course you still have to prove that you're part of the school, or that the project has been made as part of the of a school program, which apparently is also the only like real criteria that it requires, that it's at least someone you can prove in some way that, mm-hmm. it was actually a school project.
Okay.
Because I think for some other categories it can be like quite restrictive at some point.
Yeah.
You apply online then, and you our film is about 6.5 minutes, and but they only have time for a maximum of 2 minutes, so we had to edit our film and put
sort of make a best of version,
yes.
Okay.
And then also a 1 minute making of version, like where you see breakdowns and
yes.
Things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had to redo your film to be a two minute film, right?
Yeah, sort of just try and pick the best pieces, which sometimes was a little bit difficult.
Right. So,
because of course maybe the shot that doesn't look best is sort of like the one you cherish a little bit more than others.
Right.
And just try to squeeze out the most possible, maybe just cut down one shot in order to just fit in another one.
Right.
Yeah. Then you do that until the end of November, and then they got time for the shortlist. To create a shortlist, and then they say to you about beginning of January, second January week, and then the shortlist is made public.
Yeah,
and then we jumped out of our chairs and screamed loud that we were at the shortlist, and what was very positive for our school and very very cool for our students that. 3 out of 4 films in the shortlist came from our school. Our friends were our competitors.
Wow!
So in that way, maybe even that's one way that colleagues become competitors again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So 3 out of 4, because I've been a judge on the VES, and mm-hmm. I've been one of the people that sort of makes the shortlist, right?
Yes.
So that, and then obviously everyone in the VES votes for the winner itself. But it's an interesting process. What they do is they show you all of the different things, and then obviously you select, you know, which ones you give scores for everything, and then they select which one has the best score. But yeah, it's an interesting process.
Yeah, the other two were Jagan and Skull, I think,
uh-huh.
And the other one was from the Artifact School in France.
Okay.
Yeah, and that were our competitors, and then there comes a phase where the VS members have to vote.
Right.
So
I mean, then of course you try to like if you know a couple of people who might be in the VS, because of course it's like a very selective membership.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, hey, do you possibly know anyone that we might show a little bit? So maybe just get one vote out of probably the hundreds or thousands. Just mm-hmm.
It's like whatever. Yeah, we released at that time the breakdown. We made it public then.
Oh, right.
So people can also see a bit, in public about our project. We are not allowed to show the film because we have some festivals we want to send it in. And
some who?
Festivals.
Oh, right.
We want to send it in, and some of them have... restrictions that it can be public for the moment and everything, and so we showed the breakdown, and that was all we could do.
Right.
We had more possibilities to influence.
And of course, just try to think, sort of contemplating, should we go, should we not go, and in the end we decided, okay, yeah, we just have to go. Even if we don't win, it's just part of the experience, and of course.
Yes.
Yeah,
just a couple of days spending in LA meeting.
So yeah,
meeting
so
some old friends.
You guys came to LA. You said you just where you stayed. Where did you guys stay?
I think you, Francesco, you stayed at a friend, and I pretty much just booked the closest hotel nearby.
Okay,
I was lucky that maybe he listens. Thank you, Luke.
Oh, cool.
He's an awesome director from Los Angeles. Hire him.
What's Luke's last name?
Eve.
Luke Eve?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, hopefully Luke Eve will listen.
Pretty
to
cool thing. Dude from Australia.
Oh, Australia,
yeah.
Though? Oh, nice.
So do it because he was able to sleep there.
Yeah.
And to feed his cats.
And yes. To feed your cats. Awesome. So, but you were able to catch up with some old friends while you're there too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. There's a lot of the, I call it the German mafia when they come. A lot of them working over at Uncharted Territory and all kinds of places like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Especially if you have a couple of guys at Walt Disney Animation, it's like, you just meet a large table at like the closest burger house, and then you just have a nice lunch there.
Yeah.
And even then, like, just like, okay, we'll just because we just visit one of the flats, and we got a couple of hours to spend. We'll just watch a movie, and it's almost like, okay, we never left Ludwigsburg. It's just like, okay, we just meet up at some colleague's house, and which is then completely strange because not only is it already like half a year, almost a year since we finished, but also I'm in London and I just left Ludwigsburg to go to London, and now I left London to go to LA for a couple of days in order to sort of relive some of the Ludwigsburg experience.
Yeah, everywhere we go, we meet them friends from school. That's pretty cool. Yeah,
it is good. It is cool. Yeah.
So and then we also enjoyed a bit of nice hospitality from the VS. They did some studio tours after the
cool.
The award show, and it was very nice. And then we visited, for example, Walt Disney Studios, and
also the one was Funko Creative.
Yeah, Fun Davis is also here at FMX.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I've been nominated for VS, but I didn't actually win. So, yeah, it's been fun.
Try next time. Even
then, if you can just sit in that room with like an entire ballroom of like-minded people, is sort of like. Taking the sort of the more high society stuff that you probably usually won't associate with, and then add all the visual effects geek angle to that.
We had the luck to be invited by Autodesk, which is a great part of that event show, and they had a very great table right in front of the microphone.
Oh, so you stayed at the Autodesk table?
Yes, yeah. Yes, okay. And it was pretty nice. And thank you again, Autodesk, for inviting us. And it was a very cool experience because every speaker who was there, we saw them next to our table. It was very, very nice. Ridley Scott and Pete Docter and Zack Snyder was also there. So
yeah. And who was the host? Was it Patton Oswalt?
Yes.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, yeah. He's pretty good. Yeah.
He's funny.
He made a lot of fun of because Eric. I think he botched Ridley Scott's name.
Yeah, Eric Roth did a
Eric Roth was it? Yeah.
Did a mistake at the beginning of the. I don't know if we should say.
Okay.
Did a big mistake. Sorry,
Eric, for spoiling that
at the beginning of the show, and he that was then.
The theme
of the award show.
Yeah, you gotta be careful. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, there's a very sad news for Patton Oswalt recently. I was like, ugh. But this is really cool. Is tell us a little bit about what you want to do. Like, what are some of your goals and ambitions you want to get into now that you've sort of just started your new professional career? Even though, like I said, the Film Academy is pretty much the start of your professional career. But what are some of the things you'd like to do?
I'd say sort of one thing that I haven't tried yet, but should probably would be more interested in is like just trying to do more something that's focused on game cinematics or. Sort of because I think that was also a little bit of the focus on my own graduation project. So, because it wasn't this completely photorealistic style, like something that was actually shot, but has sort of a little bit of bling to it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of in the same way that game cinematics, even if they're not like if they don't hit like the photoreal mark, they somehow somehow also try to stay away from the uncanny valley.
Yep.
Just by making them a little bit more glossy in some sense that everything's sort of like. A little bit over the top, that it sort of you get a little bit more distracted by the fact that it's all done pretty, but not in a way that you sort of you have to look at it and have to sort of feel any emotion. It's more like about creating some pretty visuals, and I mean, and of course, like it's something that you can, I think, at least as a visual element, you can be pretty proud of if you produce something that looks epic and was done, of course, and especially because cinematics are done like. Not with the same budget as a feature film. It's more about getting the best visuals, the most interesting visuals, like the quickest way possible. Similar to commercials, but of course, cinematics pack a little bit more bang.
So they do, but they can take a long time. You know, I mean, I can just call it, you know, the Tron light bite sequence is pretty much a cinematic. Yeah. It's all CG, and so that took a long time to do. And I had a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. So it depends. And I think, I know, even at Blizzard, I think some of those cinematics take years to do.
But I think even the weakest shots in one of those sequences, you can still be proud to show it. In
some way, absolutely.
Because everybody pushes it just as far as possible. And even then, there's like even if it's done, some of the aspects still have to be done like very efficiently, and yep. still you can push it in some way, which I think makes it pretty interesting. So you don't have to work on every aspect in the highest quality. Just make sure that you have enough in order to push it in the right areas.
Right.
And apart from that, I think I've done a little bit of TV work, mm-hmm. which is something I also enjoyed, because sometimes if you work in film, you just spend like a year or at least half a year just maybe doing one or two shots.
Right.
But not more than that. And TV has a little bit more of this energy that every couple of weeks you try something new.
Yes. Yeah,
if you're working on an entire season, even if it's not like they have to bring up something new every episode.
Well, I also had the theory, you know, that basically like not everything you're going to do is be great, right? And in fact, one in five of the projects is usually going to be a really awesome project. So if you're working in commercials or you're working on TV stuff, you know, you'll get two or three awesome mm-hmm. projects every year. If you work in feature films,
it could be like
it'll be 5 years mm-hmm. and you'll get one project that's really awesome, you know?
And even then it's sort of like, even if it's like the worst thing you do, if it's television, it's like, okay, it's at least done after a couple of weeks.
At least it's over.
And
yeah.
then you can do something new again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fun fact, it still has an audience, because then you can still say, okay, even if it's a show that might not be the best quality, but still everybody watches it, you can still have like, you can still be a little bit proud of the fact that people enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like one of the main draws to actually do something in film, that the fact that whatever you do is going to be watched by millions across the world. But the same thing is with television, and sometimes you can sort of, it's sometimes more the easier way just to do something that people can appreciate.
But you don't really have a huge interest in doing big feature film stuff?
I'd still do.
Of course. but it's not like your goal. It's not like I want to work on the next big Star Wars or whatever.
Oh, I'd surely say Star Wars. I think when it comes to feature films, I'd probably be a little bit more selective.
Right.
Just because I say, okay, if it's the wrong film project, then I'm just going to be spending too much time on it.
I'll tell you this, though.
Enjoy it.
You don't always know if it's going to be a good one or a bad mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, of course. That's
you know, I was going to work on Real Steel, and I was like, ugh, really? Fighting robots? And end up being an awesome project. Yeah. Really mm-hmm. cool. So you never really know. Mm-hmm. So definitely.
I'd say as long as I can do some fantasy, some science fiction, then okay, I'm totally on board for it.
Okay.
I would be a little bit selective, but if the right project comes and I'd be interested, then definitely I would do it.
Okay, cool.
Maybe it's just television. It's so like, it's also is a little bit more, maybe a bit more comparable to something like being a student and just doing projects, or just sort of having the same energy, like you're going to be doing something different every other week.
Right.
And then at some point you can just say, okay, now I can actually do something for a couple of months and go to something that actually takes its time.
Right. And what about you? What's your goal? Do you like doing the production role of things?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, at the beginning of my career, I started out as an artist, and mm-hmm. I switched to producing during my work as when I was self-employed, and mm-hmm. I wanted to do a bigger project, so I hired other people, mm-hmm. and I began more and more to do project management and business development, and at one particular point, I didn't do anything more as an artist. I switched completely there, and it's okay for me, because I like to be part of the whole process and not only of one particular area, one particular field of production. So yes, I want to stay there, but I don't know exactly in which genre I will be, because one thing I learned is that you can't prepare really for life, mm-hmm. so I think I will adapt and do what I think that would be the best for me and what I like. So I can't say to you if I want to be now a visual effects producer for a big feature film project, or maybe I mean I at the Film Academy now, I did one commercial and then a short, and with live action short and mm-hmm. live action commercial now with a creature in there and a lot of destruction in the other film. And I did City Party, which is a full CG animation. So I tried a lot of those things, and but I can't say for sure at the moment in which area I will be. I think everything was fun and interesting. So yeah, let's see.
Okay. Well, that's fun. I think it's really cool that there is that role of producer in production that's at the Film Academy. I think obviously it's not something that's really taught very much or sort of fostered. And it goes beyond project management. I think it also knows you have to be able to know how to work with artists and how to do resources and all that other stuff.
And not only that, we also learn how to advertise your project at the end.
Yes.
So how to make money out of it.
Yeah,
so
marketing.
That's pretty important, especially for producers. So I just can recommend that. I don't know any other school that has this course.
I've never heard that.
And there are not many companies that know that the Film Academy has this course.
Right.
So maybe someone is hearing this now.
Yeah, no. It's
so,
really cool.
And these guys are not when they come out. They're not beginners. They know how to use a shot management software like Shotgun or F-Track or something like that. They know how to do bidding and everything.
Yeah.
They don't need to start as a junior coordinators or as a
so that's why you're going to be
production assistant.
You're being a producer right as you're walking into MPC because you already have all of that experience.
Unfortunately, not everybody had the chance who came out of this because of the problem that companies don't know that we can do that already.
Right.
So I was, I think, 50% lucky, and other 50% I was persistent because I informed them and keep them updated what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if companies would knew that we have those guys there and people who are coming out of there, are actually able to do those jobs and just need to know the company and the infrastructure and the contacts and everything. It would be nice to see more people get out of there and getting producer jobs.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. That'd be really awesome. Well, we're just about out of time and I have to go check because I have to record another podcast and I don't know if the other guests are here. But I really appreciate you guys coming by. This is awesome. It's nice to be here in Stuttgart, and this press room has been quite nice to be able to be involved in. So we're just going to do a couple things. We're going to take a photo with the Polaroid, which will be great. Maybe we can just do it at the booth. We can go walk together at the booth.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And then I'll have you sign them. And then we'll also, the other thing I want to do is, I guess that's it. Mm-hmm. It would be great. You guys live in town or around here?
So for the moment, yes.
Okay.
For the weekend.
Yes. For the weekend. Okay, great. And you're going to go back to London, I guess.
Yeah, on Monday.
And that's when do you start at MPC?
In about 2.5 weeks.
Oh, wow. All right. That sounds great. You have a place to live out there? Or you'll figure it out.
I'm figuring out after FMX. So.
Okay, perfect. All right, guys. Well, I'm going to let the last bucket drop because that's what we say at the end of the podcast. So,
all right.
But I appreciate it. All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.